Today's program was brought to you by Whole Foods Market. For more information, visit wholefoodsmarket.com.
Welcome to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Elizabeth Thacker-Jones of the Food Book Fair, coming to Brooklyn from May 4th through the 6th of this year. It's only a few weeks away. You ready?
We're ready. 2 weeks and 3 days.
Oh, so you have like one of those calendars with circles and X's and...
Pretty much, yeah. We do, yeah.
The Food Book Fair... I'm sure it has plenty of influences per its impetus, but where did you start thinking about food? Where did you grow up, and what were you eating? What were you cooking?
Sure. I grew up in Westchester County in a small suburban town called Scarsdale. And
you say that like it's like this quaint little... I'm from Croydon.
Okay,
so when
yes,
someone says Westchester to me, I know Westchester.
Yes, it's incredibly... incredibly bucolic, but yeah, also very suburban.
Very boring, very, and serene, yes, but safe.
Yes, yeah, very safe. And I grew up as sort of a microwave chef. I got really kind of fancy with my microwave pizza.
Oh, yeah.
And
Elio's?
A lot of Elio's, yeah, a lot of like pizza bagels. My parents were, you know, working and not really cooking for us. So... I soon discovered the joy of cooking when I was in high school. My older sister worked at a well-known restaurant in Tribeca called Chanterelle, and she was there for about 10 years. And I had this epiphany when I actually went and got to experience the food there. And I was in high school, so yeah, I was incredibly young, and it was sort of this, you know, she was an actress and... working, you know, very, very crazy long hours at this gorgeous restaurant where the food was so much the center of, and the taste was so much the center of attention in this space. And, you know, in the very, like, sort of bleak warehouse area in Tribeca.
Yeah. But it was so overtly influenced by art as well, which is kind of an amazing convergence and for this show. Food, though, stood, you know, kind of alone in that restaurant as this focal point, had so many amazing outside influences.
Definitely. Especially the menu design. Every week they had a different artist,
yeah,
who put, you know, the gorgeous menu together based on the inspiration of the food. Maybe it was, maybe it wasn't.
Yeah.
But they had artists that dined there as well, and they were part of that community.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that was absolutely an eye-opening thing, eating at Chanterelle.
It was. It was absolutely eye-opening. And then I started cooking at home for my family. And I learned very later on that my grandfather was a farmer who grew up in Missouri. And so my mom sort of grew up on a farm, but she didn't really share that information readily for some reason, I think. There are many reasons why.
Yeah.
And I ended up going to Oberlin College after I graduated, and I ended up cooking in a co-op, which was in 1998. And it was a vegan co-op that had a non-honey option to every meal. So we were cooking for about 250 people. And that was really where I was exposed to different types of vegetables, different types of grains. I mean, there was no refined sugar, and this is like 1998, which, you know, is sort of a formative time, I think, when people were thinking about veganism as a way that you could incorporate it into your life here and there, or it could be a way of life.
Yeah. So, I mean, it was when food and kind of activism were co-aligning a little bit more, or becoming a voice.
Yeah, definitely at Oberlin, you know, having 250 people in a co-op that were talking about, you know, pickles and strawberries and sort of the history of those products and how they had become. I actually remember a group, so I say pickles because there was a group of students that made a paper mache pickle and took it across campus, and they're protesting the practices of the Vlasic at the time. So putting, you know, connecting those dots of yeah, true activism, but also the taste was really important.
Yeah.
At the end of the day, we would spend, you know, 10 hours sometimes prepping for our meals just for, you know, Monday night dinner.
Yeah.
Knowing that we had this challenge ahead of us.
So what gave you the chops to be able to cook then? I mean, you got your first kind of cooking job at an experimental space called The Kitchen when you were, what, like 19 years old?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so that was really my experience in the co-op at Oberlin, and then working at The Kitchen, which is the performance art space on 19th Street in Chelsea that has really nothing to do with food.
I think I've often gone to the website thinking, oh, this is going to be perfect for some kind of like food art event, and then, yeah, it's...
Right. But it also, they, you know, they care about food and they're using the kitchen as a metaphor.
Yeah.
And so to have someone who's there cooking for the lunches for the summer program that was really focused on experimental music and dance and really amazing teachers like Philip Glass and Meredith Monk. And I sort of knew who they were, but I was also just sort of wanted to make really delicious food again. And, you know, they set it up so that the staff at The Kitchen could actually get, you know, get a meal from what I was making for the artist. And by the end of that week, it was just like, there was a line of the staff people and, you know, I had to make sure there was enough food for them. And it was also a way for me to make a couple extra dollars too.
Yeah.
So I was psyched.
What did Philip Glass once tell you about lentils?
Oh, he said I made the best lentils he'd ever had.
Yeah, did he tell you that with three some odd minutes of silence or something? Of terrible reference. But cooking for these people that, you know, were creative probably made you more creative. How did you start rethinking food? Was it just sustenance, or was it something more than that?
It was definitely always something more. And I think at Oberlin too, when I was studying art, so then again, you know, it was sort of, I was always, cooking to support my, what I hoped would be an art career. And, I ended up following the food all the way to California, where I moved after college, and I worked for a sustainable caviar company, which was a total like wild story in itself, that I was working on a sturgeon farm, and we were raising these white sturgeon that were indigenous to Northern California and the Sacramento River Valley, and I was then exposed to this sort of sustainable, properly marketed sustainable food world that was then growing out of the Ferry Building and Quesa, and the caviar was sort of the super high-end product. And the way to communicate how these ideas of, you know, sustainable fish farming and, you know, taste and cuisine and all sort of in one big pot.
Yeah.
That was sort of the next like intellectualizing that experience to try to understand the fisheries, which is gigantic. I mean, that's not where I don't consider myself an expert in at all, which I think is part of how the book fairs come about too, is like having these little like in and outs of micro immersions in very unique settings with very unique artists and practitioners who spend, you know, their lives. I mean, academics, especially within our food studies program, you know, there are several like Fabio Periscoli and Krishnendu Ray and and McBride, all of whom are scholars who are immersed in food studies. And it's really their ideas that we're sort of then extrapolating and acting upon in real life in these situations that are very often entrepreneurial, you know, they're businesses at the end of the day. So,
well, it's also surrounding yourself by, it's delegating, it's surrounding yourself by experts. And when you were sturgeon farming, I mean, I'm not going to gloss over that. The guy's name is Tsar. You know, it's Tsar Nikolai Caviar. And you went there because that was an expert in the field. I mean, how did you initially get hooked up with a job like that? Was it just felicity?
Sure. I actually was working in publishing. So that was it was for a travel book called The Guest Informant. And it was the first book under the Bible in the hotel room. So first book that before, you know, Lonely Planet, before the internet.
Yeah.
The concierge at the, you know, the concierge desk had a book, and it was full of restaurant and museum and, you know, sites to recommendations to, you know, to where to go in the city. And so that was where I ended up, as I, again, one of these sort of, I was at Kinko's, I was printing out my resume. Someone saw my resume on the computer and said, your resume fits this description. So, and that's how it happened, honestly. So the woman that I worked for at the Guest Informant, she was asked to go work for the caviar company, so I followed her. And she had spent time in Paris in culinary school, and so she had this real interest in the burgeoning food movement and the chefs happening in San Francisco. So that's how it ended up. And I was there for a day, and I almost left.
Yeah,
it was. I mean, you know, raising a sturgeon, it's in captivity, it's about 12 years before you can take the eggs, and that's the female, obviously. In out in the wild, it's about 15 plus years. So you can imagine this company has been around. They won a James Beard Award in the early 90s and only really had enough product, caviar, to fulfill the market need after, like, 15 years of being in business.
That's quite an investment.
Yes. And there was there's a great farm out in Idaho, actually, that I got to visit. As I worked with the company, I became more involved in the science side of things, meaning compliance. So just making sure our ducks in a row were in a row with the EPA and the Fish and Wildlife.
Yeah.
That was intense, and so not necessarily expected. But
learning all those logistics help understand a business that much more.
Oh, absolutely. And a lot of food businesses start that in, you know, they're very small and you wear many hats, and it's not just that's their whole trajectory is playing all of those roles.
And so when were you bike tour guide in Sonoma? Was that prior or was that after?
That was after.
Fresh air.
That was after. I actually continued doing a little bit of work with Tsar Nikolai Caviar, and then decided, yes, it was time to build on my all this entrepreneurial energy that was growing. And in 2004, that summer was just biking around Sonoma. We threw a sticker with our logo on a big white van and threw our bikes into the van, and we went around to these gorgeous biodynamic wineries. And that was just a very short season. That was right before I decided to move back east. So that was amazing. But again, the market was also something that, you know, had to sort of bear this new idea. And in France and overseas, biking while sipping wine through wine country is much more accepted.
Everyone just likes going on that train in Sonoma, which actually leads to nowhere.
Right.
It's back and forth and back and forth. And so do you have favorite wineries in Sonoma still?
I do. I have a good friend that works at Nahl. So I'm NALE. I'm a huge fan of Nahl wines. They do a great zin. Preston is awesome. Bella, all in the Dry Creek Valley. They're all really high quality.
So you're leaving the beautiful hyperclimates of California and coming back east. Why?
I decided to go back to school. And I thought I would go to business school. And I took a break. I spent some time in Maine where my family had relocated to Maine. And I worked in a bakery, an amazing bakery called Two Fat Cats in Portland. And I made pies. And it was heaven. And I applied to business school. And then I had this epiphany where I decided, actually, I needed to move back to New York City, where I thought I would never move, having grown up outside of New York City, and moved to Brooklyn. And then I worked for David Rockwell of the Rockwell Group. And I was...
Who's an amazing architect who's done many restaurants too, right?
Yes. Yeah. So that was really a perfect place for me to immerse myself in Manhattan and the greater sort of that vibe, I guess, the buzz of Manhattan and living in Brooklyn, but also the restaurant scene, which was becoming, so important. So important to the identity of Manhattan as a feeder for these chefs who were making names for themselves, who were writing books. The Rockwell Group, they built themselves around the W Hotel brand and the Nobu restaurants. By the time I was there, they were looking at doing a Nobu in Herzliya, just north of Tel Aviv. I mean, really like New York-centric than brands that became international. And we were part of a strategy team that got to think about all of that and research and read food blogs and, you know, the food trucks, all the food trucks were kind of picking up speed at that time. And we did a lot of ideation, like that word ideation and innovation. And we had, what I'm sure they probably still call themselves fungineers, these guys who basically use technology to create immersive experiences, whether it be how to look at a wine menu or just walk into a space and the atmosphere changes based upon your heat or where you're looking or where you're standing. So really, and you know, David Rockwell still does incredibly large scale projects and just beautiful, a lot of attention towards theatrics.
Yeah, so it's bringing interactivity back into what was, I'm not saying flaccid, but was a very regimented industry for a long, long time. Mm-hmm. And now there's a little bit more play in mm-hmm. restaurants, personality. Mm-hmm. And you see that, as you said, reflected maybe in cookbooks and in ventures outside of the restaurant. Mm-hmm. But to systematically create something, and that be your identity, or that be your projection. It was so standardized for so long. So David Rockwell was a real pioneer in how to individualize restaurants and spaces and experiences. So from there, mm-hmm. moving to the Green Market. Mm-hmm. And this was just last year when you helped organize. What was that pavilion?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so when I left Rockwell and I started the food studies program at NYU, so I did end up going back to school. I'm still in the program. I'm finishing.
It's everybody's hotel, California. You'll never get away.
Right, I know. Yeah. Exactly. So I was then, I guess Green Market was a very sort of almost temporary luck of the draw, where they had this pavilion space on the north end of Union Square, which you probably are familiar with. It's the limestone structure with the columns, and that will become a restaurant based upon, you know, the sort of synergy with my background as being interested in all of these like matchups, I guess, like food and fill in the blank. The space was open for programming. So it was with great honor that I got to bring in, I had a homesteading fair. This was a convergence of people making making pickling food, but and making jam, but also sewing and quilting, and they just such a wide range of sort of the homesteading, what falls under that umbrella. And we also did a lot of work with Columbia Teachers College and the Center for the Food and the Environment, and they develop curriculum for elementary school students to actually go into schools and teach food studies, which I call food studies. Yeah. You know, nutrition is sort of there's sort of a line in the sand, at least within the food studies and the nutrition program, where there are a lot of important nutritional issues that go into food studies, but there's a need for us to learn where our food comes from and also perhaps bring a historical and a sense of place to the way we consume. And perhaps it so happens that nutrition can tag along
yeah.
those ideas. So they put it in an incredibly digestible, fun, and the just Pam Cook, who is the head of the program, she has several books out and is a huge pioneer in farm-to-table education and school-guarded initiatives. So that was great to be able to work with their team. And we actually had a puppet show that was crafted in the 70s by the Center for Food and the Environment that they resurrected for the pavilion.
Digging
really
up
fun.
These relics.
Yes. Yeah.
So we're going to take a quick break and come back about, you know, where the impetus and ideation of the Food Book Fair came from through all those experiences. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. We'll be right back.
And sustainable seafood at Whole Foods Market. On April 22nd, Earth Day 2012, we'll be eliminating all red-rated species of wild-caught fish and seafood from our stores across the country. It's our way of supporting our oceans and helping to reverse trends in overfishing. Learn more at blueoceaninstitute.org and wholefoodsmarket.com.
Hey, and welcome back to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkel, here today with Elizabeth Thacker-Jones of the Food Book Fair. We were just talking about your past a whole bunch and how this journey led you to a point where you said, hey, there needs to be a food book fair. Coming from the green market and putting together all these kind of, performances, in the sense, you know, public spaces. Where did the Food Book Fair come from?
Well, the Food Book Fair, actually the first conversation was with the green market. And we realized that, there are farmers who have published books. Many of them have self-published books. And I believe there's five or six. And we thought, why don't we do a green market book yeah. fair in the pavilion, and it didn't happen in that space, mostly mostly because we couldn't sell anything out of the space. Every event had to be free. So then I talked about it with so many different people, and the reaction was, you know, it's ambitious, but this hasn't happened yet, really?
Yeah.
Is this not something that has happened in you know, in Brooklyn yet, or, you know, we realize there is a book fair in Paris. It's a cookbook fair. There's also IACP, which has a book fair.
Elementary school.
Elementary school book fairs. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But the food book, sort of focusing in what is a food book? Is it a cookbook? Is it an academic book? Is it a memoir? Is it a journal? There are so many different kinds of books that talk about food. And the idea was really about bringing those all into the same place and the authors who are writing them also, and the readers. The readers who are looking to connect the dots. Part of the, going back to my career therapy session, I think a lot of people are interested in food and are working in doing something around food, whether it's a personal project or a family project, but are also perhaps their career is in another discipline. And that is really sort of the audience for the book fair in some ways. It's industry, but it's also folks that want to learn a little bit more about the authors that perhaps cookbook writers are reading. A lot of ideas, a lot of voice and frame around cookbooks is often based on a set of values.
Yeah.
And a set of aesthetics. And there are many books out there that are writing about those values.
So it's not like farm to table just happened because it was pretty. Pickling didn't happen because it was nice to photograph a bottle being backlit. There were institutions and ideas in place already.
Yeah. And I think we definitely know that from, yeah. You know, from Rachel Carson and Silent Spring. And then, you know, we look at Michael Pollan and Food Inc., which are sort of the big ones if we're talking about food systems and sustainability. But there are also other books that are written from the point of view of architects and designers. There are also artists that are using food as a medium or talking about food in their artwork. And it's, you know, it's not necessarily in the same, the framework can be totally different.
Yeah. Well, I'm lucky enough to be on a panel with two of those who have been prior guests on this show, Tattoo Tan and Jennifer Rubel, who I didn't know you were one of the nurses during her incubation
I was.
Performances. Mm-hmm. Can you explain a little bit about that project and your role with her?
Sure. So I have worked with Jennifer for over 2 years as basically whatever she's needed. I've helped her with specifically relating to sourcing of material and getting sort of the nuts and bolts for a project. So in that realm, I got to actually perform within the piece, which was kind of the ultimate,
yeah.
The ultimate form of participation within her work, which is so incredibly prolific, I think, in looking at the pictures, but also if you have the opportunity to experience her project, it's really transformative. So there was definitely a lot of conversation about that when I started working with her, you know, this idea of how eating and experiencing art can be extremely ephemeral, and in that realm also somewhat elite in some conversations, because it happens and then it's gone. And you know, what is sort of the philosophy and feeling behind food as a discipline that deserves recognition on a higher level, and that I believe the systems side is what sort of fuels the systems, those ideas that are grounded in environmental issues and sustainability and those sorts of things are what sort of help to build out the energy that we're feeling around food, feeling of these artists and these designers using it in innovative and wild ways. So the incubation project, I think, really tied in a lot of those ideas in that I was basically in a white box. And I was in what we called finally, fondly, was a yogurt nurse.
An inoculating yogurt nurse.
And
that's a hell of a thing to put on a resume.
I know. Yeah, that was pretty much the ultimate. I said, okay, I have to do a book fair, something really simple now.
But see, that kind of mantra, though, did inform the book fair, because I feel like a lot of the same values that Jennifer has of interaction and, you know, informing people of some deeper meaning is what the book fair is bringing to Brooklyn this May. I wanted to start going over some of the panels, too, because you were talking about how you're a food plus fill in the blank. All these panels have that, you know, moniker. There's a food plus art plus medium.
Which is your panel.
Which is my panel. If you want to stop by and see me completely intimidated off a radio and see why I hide in a little box behind Roberta's. There's a food plus tech plus content. There's a food plus culture plus taste. There's a food plus cities, a food plus media plus movements, food plus cooking plus change, food plus lit plus magazines. But just to see that there is something bigger than just food, you know, in this equation, that there are all these varying influences, but are bringing all these amazing people together in the same place to talk about overall a very, you know, singular thing. How can we change how we look at food and how we interact with food? And I don't mean just like with sustenance, but with sustainable, you know, ideas in our heads. Who do you have headlining this thing? Not to say that there are any one person, you know.
Well, Marianne Nessel is really my favorite.
Yeah.
Marianne, who has been a professor of mine, and she's also written Food Politics and What to Eat, and she was one of the founders of the Food Cities program. I think it was 14 years ago now at NYU, and I feel like she is a must see for anybody who's interested in deeper immersive learning about food culture and food systems, both of those.
She starts off the whole thing.
She kicks
on
it off.
That Friday, May 4th, at what time?
It's 8:45 we're starting, so get there as close to 8:45 as you can.
It's worth waking up early for this one.
It's worth it.
So people like Harold Miggy are also involved, who's, you know, legendary food and cooking, has influenced not just the sciences, but the approach to how people think about technique and methodology. Then you have some amazing food plus experiments, food plus studies. Who are some of the other people that you think people don't know already and should really check in on?
I think food plus cities, which is Sarah Rich and Nicola Twilley. Nicola writes a blog called Edible Geography. And Sarah and Nicola have been working together for several years. They had what they call the Food Print Project, which ended up being an actual series of events. I believe it was in 2010. It was in New York, and it traveled to Mexico City. They're putting one together for Los Angeles. And they're both really excellent writers who look at food science and sort of urban planning. So really incredible emerging thoughts around our food system and looking at cities. And the two of them, to have them both here and together, and Sarah has a book coming out called Urban Farms with Abrams, and she wrote and was significantly part of the world-changing book that came out, I guess that was 5 years ago or so. I would say that's Friday evening, and that should be a great one. And that's also just the two of them, whereas many other panels have four or five or six and some different people who will be talking more about themselves or, you know, more about their practices and their work individually and showing slides. And I think that is, especially the art panel, I think, is for those who are interested in food's relationship to art. This has so many heavy hitters.
It's going to be
hitters.
Exciting. Cooks Plus Books with Daniel Halpern of Echo. Is someone, I'm assuming, talking as a publisher and talking about cookbooks in general. I mean, being that this is a Food Book Fair, I'm not, you know, not talking about cookbooks, but showing people that there's so much more to cookbooks than just the, you know, bound version that they have in their hands.
Mm-hmm. Well, Daniel Halpern is actually, so he started Echo, and that's an imprint of HarperCollins. And he just came out with, Echo just came out with April Bloomfield's book, and she's actually going to be joining him.
Oh, awesome.
Along with J.J. Good, her ghostwriter. So that should be a really interesting conversation, the three of them talking about ghostwriting and this sort of interest and discovery around how chefs have the time to sit down and write a memoir.
Exactly.
And a cookbook, a hybridized book.
So there are books, but there's also foodieticals, which I love that compound term. And you have a dozen or so of those, but you have books there too, for sale. Over 100 titles, I'm assuming.
About 100, yep.
And how is that format going to work? Or is it going to be like a little trailer that they park outside the school and you go during lunch?
That would be great. We are doing this in the same event space at the Wythe Hotel. We'll be clearing out some of the chairs and old school, you know, U-shaped tables, and each foodieoticle, each journal, periodical, or magazine will have a table, and they'll just talk up their stuff.
Yeah.
And some of them, Wilder Quarterly is one I hadn't heard of until recently. They're Brooklyn based. I'm hoping we're going to get some copies of Design Indaba, which is their food issue, which is out of South Africa. So it should be quite the, for a pack rat like myself, who's constantly trying to find the most frayer books that are related to food and talk about, for example, Design Indaba, there's a dialogue between Marion Nessel and Paola Antonelli, who is the design curator at MoMA. And I just love that sort of matchup where someone, you know, two practitioners from completely different backgrounds are now chiming in about food system.
Yeah. And aside from all these magazines, books on display, there are going to be author signings. There's going to be interaction past just listening, you know, to a panel. And there will be people there that I'm sure would be happy to interact with the general public. I really feel like this is going to be an amazing kind of space for people to interact, to discuss, aside from just what's on schedule.
Yes, thank you.
Yeah. And it's foodbookfair.com.
It is.
Mm-hmm. And there are tickets available.
There are tickets available for the panels. The author signings are free. The bookstore is open. It's all happening at a new hotel opening in Williamsburg. And that's on Wythe and North 12th, across the street from Brooklyn Bowl, Brooklyn Brewery. And literally you'll walk in to the front door, and that's where our author signings and our bookstore are, appropriately in the library of the hotel. And then in the event space is where all the panels will happen for all day Friday, all day Saturday, all day Sunday.
Now, I remember there was like a Kickstarter campaign.
Oh, no.
Yeah. No, not oh, no. But it certainly got the word out.
Yes.
You know, and how can people help the Food Book Fair? Because I want to see this as something that doesn't just happen this year, that, you know, continues on. How can people volunteer their time, mm-hmm. Donate their monies, their efforts?
Absolutely. Yeah, we did have a Kickstarter, and we were very ambitious, and we then downsized, and, you know, we're still quite large, actually.
Yeah,
we have over 50 participants, and I would say the best way to support would be to come out and come to a panel and buy a ticket and come to a panel and really, pick your favorite panel or come and see something that you maybe would never venture out to see before, because there are some, you know, really fascinating people in town, partly because it's the same weekend as the James Beard Awards. And I would say that would be the best way. And come also look at the bookstore and follow us online. Follow our progression. We hope to grow and, perhaps happen in another city.
Yep.
At some point
it's
soon.
It's just the beginning. So. Well, I hope to see everyone there May 4th.
Yes.
And 5th and 6th. Foodbookfair.com. Elizabeth, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
On the way out, what's your favorite cookbook right now?
Ooh, tough. Well, on my mind today, what is the recipe that chef Mark Andrew Gravel is coming. He's coming out with a book called Kill the Recipe, and he's actually going to be cooking at a dinner during the fair. And so his book, Kill the Recipe, which I got a sneak peek at, I would say that's my favorite one. And it's about beans. It's like a how-to cookbook about heirloom awesome. Beans.
Yeah. Well, looking forward to that, and beans abound. Foodbookfair.com. Check it out. Buy tickets. See the panels. Buy some books. You've been listening to The Food Scene on HeritageRadioNetwork.com. I'm your host, Michael Harlan Turkell. Hoping to have you back here next Tuesday at 3. Cheers.
Thanks for listening to this program on the Heritage Radio Network. You can find all of our archived programs on HeritageRadioNetwork.com, as well as a schedule of upcoming live shows. You can also podcast all of our programs on iTunes by searching Heritage Radio Network in the iTunes Store. You can find us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter for up-to-date news and information. Thanks for listening.